From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Today, we remember Melvin Van Peebles, considered the godfather of black cinema, who died last week. He's best known for his 1971 film, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. Early in his career, after making some short independent films, Van Peebles went to Hollywood.
And they offered me a job as an elevator operator. I said, no, you don't understand. I like to write, I like to direct. And then they explained to me that one day my people might learn to operate this complicated equipment, et cetera, et cetera.
We'll listen back to our interview with him and with his son Mario, who made a film about the making of Sweetback. We'll also remember Bishop John Shelby Spong, who died earlier this month, and I'll review the new Netflix series, Made. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, professor of television studies at Rowan University in New Jersey, in for Terry Gross. We're going to start today's show by remembering Melvin Van Peebles. He died last week at age 89. His death was announced by his son, actor and director Mario Van Peebles. We'll hear from him later in the show. Melvin Van Peebles is best known for his 1971 film Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, which he wrote, directed, scored, produced, and starred in. He played Sweetback, a young black man in L.A. who was on the run after a violent altercation with police, trying to save the life of a Black Panther who was being beaten by two white LAPD cops. It was dedicated to, quote, all the black brothers and sisters who have had enough of the man, unquote. Although the film's success helped open the door to Hollywood for other black filmmakers, Van Peebles never quite walked through that door himself. After Sweetback, Van Peebles left filmmaking. He produced two Broadway shows, wrote for television, worked as a Wall Street trader, and wrote a book about stock options. Terry Gross spoke with him in 1990 and asked why he cast himself in the starring role as Sweetback.
Well, number of reasons. First, I needed someone with a large understanding of cinema who had a number of years of experience in it, and the people that had that number of years of experience in the cinema generally were not of the street ilk that I needed, one. Two, those that were wanted him to have more lines. He said 6 lines in the whole movie. And they had been taught that lines equal a size of film, a size of a part. Do you follow me?
Mm-hmm, sure do.
And I didn't want him to talk a lot. He didn't have to talk a lot. And that's why I did it.
There were a couple of weeks when Sweetback outdid Love Story at the box office, which is pretty extraordinary considering it was an independently produced film. How did you independently get that kind of distribution?
Well, I didn't independently get that kind of distribution. What I simply did was make a good movie. Only 2 theaters in the United States would show it. 2 theaters at all would show the movie. And they did so well, then everybody called me. And at that stage of the game, hey, it was their turn in the barrel. I made deals, and the audience went to see it. That's how that happened.
Your film, Sweetback, was considered to be the first of the blaxploitation films. What you did was you took the action genre and put it into a black politicized context. And I'd really be interested in hearing what gave you the idea to do that.
Well, being alive really gave me the idea of doing it. I just got the reason, my original reason for going into films was that I had gotten tired of seeing blacks portrayed in an image that I didn't agree with. And so I said, gee, I can do better than that. And if you don't control your images, then you don't have a base for controlling your destiny. So I wanted to control how I was perceived, and therefore I went into films. Now, you said something very interesting when you said that the film was the first blaxploitation film. It was not really the blaxploitation film. It started blaxploitation, which took out the political content and just kept the action and the winning black person. In fact, the revolutionary aspect of Sweetback was put at a 180-degree turn and became almost an apology for the man. Up until that time, there had really been no black movies that mirrored the ethos, the wants and the desires of the lumpen proletariat, the urban proletariat. And that's what Sweetback did.
Well, you're talking about wanting to make movies that had an image that you believed in. Now, Sweetback was praised by a lot of people for being a black film, you know, made by blacks, starring blacks, set in the black community. On the other hand, it was criticized by many people within the black community for having its hero be the real stud. And some people saw that as perpetuating a stereotype instead of shattering it. And I wonder what you thought of those criticisms and what you think of them now in retrospect.
Well, I thought that Jesus Christ was nothing but a carpenter in his own hometown, and so it really didn't bother me too much. I think that's completely valid, what they said, and I disagree with it 100%. That is, you can take a stereotype, and you don't have to run from it. You can take it to the other side and throw it back a la jujitsu and use that stereotype as the impetus for your force. You see, I could have taken Sweetback and had him a college professor, but that was not the situation of the people that I wanted to talk to, the large group of people that I wanted to talk to. I took Sweetback from, let's say, one of the lowest possible common denominators in the community and therefore moved him forward. I didn't move him forward from some elevated period or position in the community from the first place, whereas the people once again left out in the cold. It wasn't somebody that they knew. That's why I felt that the audience reacted so positively, the major audience, much of the intelligentsia or many of the cultural nationalists did not like that move. Well, that is a valid point of view. It doesn't happen to be my own.
You were one of the first, or perhaps the first, black director of a feature-length film.
Well, I was probably the first of a commercial feature film outside of, after Oscar Michaud went out of business in around 1932 with the advent of sound, he had to phase out. I came back to the States in 1967 as one of the French delegates to the San Francisco Film Festival. No one knew I was an American, let alone black. And I had lived in Europe for many years, and I was a French journalist and then writer. And there was a law that a French writer can have a director's card to direct his own work. So one of my novels I turned into a film script, and that's how I got a French director's card, and that's how the film was made in France.
So you started your film career in France?
No, I didn't start making movies in France. I made movies in San Francisco when I used to drive a cable car many years ago.
Oh, I see. So you'd made like small, short, independent films.
I made short, independent films, and I went to Hollywood with my films, and I said, here are my films, here's some of my work, I've written the story, etc., and I'd like a job. And they offered me a job as an elevator operator. I said, no, you don't understand. I'd like to write. I'd like to direct. Then they offered me a job as a tap dancer or a dancer. You know, I said, hey, guys, that's not what I had in mind. And then they explained to me that one day my people might learn to operate this complicated equipment, et cetera, et cetera. And the rainfall at Kilimanjaro was this, that, and the other, you know. And I was at that juncture. I left America.
And you went to France?
No, I went to Holland to get my PhD in astronomy. I used to be an astronomer. And however, those early first films I made were seen in France. Henri Langlois, who started really the first cinema museum, the Cinémathèque Française, declared me a genius and looked me up. And I was living in Holland at the time and said I should be making films. Well, once he called me a genius, I said, finally, there's somebody who understands me.
So you don't think it would have been possible to start your career as a director had you just stayed in America?
What do I know? I mean, it didn't seem that it was burgeoning with opportunity at the time.
Mm-hmm. You ended up leaving movies to work on Wall Street. You were probably, when you started on Wall Street, one of the few black traders with a seat on the exchange.
I was the only black trader on the American Stock Exchange at the time I started there. There were, I think, five brokers. Now, a broker is different than a trader. A broker works on the commission, and he executes orders for others. A trader executes from his own, for his account or his own company's account, and he does not work on a commission.
So what was it like being the only black trader on the exchange?
Well, I've been in a number of other situations. I was the first Black Eagle Scout in the Pohegan Trails. I was the first first Black navigator in my squadron. I was the first Black and out of ROTC in my college. You know, on and on and on and on, on again. It was not particularly disconcerting to me.
In your new book, No Identity Crisis, your son Mario, with tongue-in-cheek, calls you his lizard dad.
Right.
It talks about you as being the person who really lacks diplomacy when it comes to, dealing with somebody.
I gave it the office. My diplomacy was worn away a few years ago. Well, a long time ago.
Did you ever have any?
I can't remember back that far. That's very unfair. How do I know? As I look back, I don't think that was one of my strong points.
Melvin Van Peebles speaking to Terry Gross in 1990. He died last week at age 89. After a break, we'll hear from his son, actor and director Mario Van Peebles, who made a film about the making of his father's film, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Next, we're going to hear from actor and director Mario Van Peebles, the son of filmmaker Melvin Van Peebles, who died last week. Mario Van Peebles made his directorial debut with the 1991 movie New Jack City, in which he also co-starred. He also played Malcolm X in the film Ali and directed Panther, a film about the Black Panther Party. He made his movie debut when he was a boy in his father's 1971 film, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. More than 30 years later, Mario wrote and directed Badass, a movie about the making of his father's 1971 groundbreaking film. That was the occasion of his interview with Terry. He starred in the film in the role of his father, Melvin. Here's Mario as his father in a scene from the film. Melvin's agent is trying to negotiate a 3-picture deal with the studio. The studio wants a follow-up to his film Watermelon Man, one that doesn't have anything to do with Sweetback. The agent is played by Saul Rubinek.
This idea I got is kind of like a ghetto western. In fact, the brother even wears like a black kind of cowboy hat.
Yeah.
And dig this, man, at the end of the movie, when he gets away, words come blazing across the screen. Badass nigga's gonna come back and collect some dues.
What, have you lost your mind? Are you taking drugs now?
Melvin, listen to me. On Watermelon Man, your white lead is supposed to wake up from this nightmare where he's a black guy and turn back into being white again. You said, no, being black is not a nightmare, and you didn't shoot the ending the studio wanted. Who backed you 100%?
Me, so why are you doing this to me? I can't take this kind of inflammatory to a major studio. Nobody legitimate is going to talk badass. No one! You know how hard we worked to get here? Melvin, just do the comedy, okay? All right, look, they're coming here. Listen, you know what this is? You're terrified you're going to fail, so you're failing yourself. Nothing to do with being black or blue or green. You hear me? It's self-destruction. Hey, Marty. Alan. How you doing? So, listen.
Now, why did you want to make a film about the making of the film?
Yeah, great. That's a good idea. Well, you know, it was an interesting process for me. Why did I make Badass? And I was on the set of Ali and being directed by Michael Mann. And we had these great sort of political discussions. And Michael is a real historian. And, of course, Ali is there himself. And I started to think about the notion, if Ali were, you know, one of the first athletes to use the ring, not just to box, but to stand for something, then Melvin Van Peebles was one of the first filmmakers to use the silver screen, not just to entertain us, but to stand for something, to say, we no longer want to be depicted as butlers and maids or as uber Negroes trying to fit in and guess who's coming to dinner. That's fine. It's got its place. But there's also a place for folks, black folks in cinema that do live to the end, that do have a sexuality, that are empowered and are not just sort of dealing with the oppressor. And so I thought, no, I'll go see my dad. My dad's got a great book on the making of Sweetback. And my dad said, yeah, I love you. If you want the book, I don't want to get screwed on the deal. You have to option it and pay for it like everybody else. And if you play me or whoever plays me, don't make me too damn nice. And as you saw in the movie Badass, I didn't sugarcoat him. He is who he is.
Now, you were 12 years old when your father was making Sweet Sweet Back?
Yeah, 12 going on 13.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a small, famous or infamous part
in
Sweet Sweet Back's Badass song. I want you to describe the scene that you're in.
Well, actually, I'm in two scenes.
One, you know the scene I want you to describe.
People tend to remember more than others. Yeah. I blew up a car where I did keep my afro. And the other scene is the beginning of the movie where I play, ironically, Sweetback as a kid. So I'm playing my dad's character as a kid, and now in Badass, I'm playing my dad as an adult. But in the Sweetback scene as a kid, you see how Sweetback gets his name. And Sweetback was an old sort of blues term about a guy that was good at making love. And so as a kid, he gets initiated with this prostitute in a brothel. And I play the kid in that scene. And then it turns into my dad playing Sweetback. I often tease him that I'd like another crack at the role now. But you know, at the time, I didn't want to. I didn't want to be working with him on the movie after a while. I thought my dad and I didn't always get along. I would never put my kids in a scene like this. But I came to understand him differently as a man, you know, walking in those shoes.
Well, in 1990, I interviewed your father, and I asked him about why he cast you in that scene. And I want to play you that part of the interview. It'll just take a minute. So here it is, a 1990 interview with Melvin Van Peebles, who is the father of my guest, Mario Van Peebles.
Sweetback, the movie opens with a 10-year-old Sweetback finding a home for himself in a whorehouse and having his sexual initiation with a 40-year-old woman. And it's a fairly explicitly done scene. They're both nude. He's in between her legs. And this is your son in that role, your 10-year-old son. I was astonished when I found out it was your son. What made you decide to cast him in that part?
Well, one, he tends to look like me, being my
right.
son and all.
Yeah.
And what I always found very interesting was people saying, but it's your son. But every child is someone's son, and I wouldn't ask my son or myself to do anything that I wouldn't ask of anyone else's child. I don't have that differentiation of, well, it's mine, and therefore it cannot be.
Let me just ask you, how much did your son know about sex when that scene was shot? I mean, did he get what was happening?
Well, let me put it this way. He wanted a bicycle for Christmas, so he didn't have a lot of leverage. And I didn't ask him, actually. Well, he did say something rather funny, though. He said, Dad, is this going to be an X movie? I said, yes. He said, phew, oh, I don't want the kids at school to see me.
Okay, so that's Melvin Van Peebles, recorded in 1990. Mario, what did you think of his answer that he wouldn't have asked his son to do anything that he wouldn't have asked anyone else's son to do, and he wouldn't have asked anyone else's son to do something that he couldn't ask his own son to do?
You know what? I didn't enjoy it at all. I didn't want to be in that scene. I didn't want to have to give that lovely bike back. That bike had a banana seat. And I didn't want to get my afro cut. Luckily, I got to keep my, you know, afro intact.
One of the things your father mentioned when I was talking to him is that you asked how the movie would be rated, and you were relieved when it was X, he told you it would be X-rated because you didn't want your friends to see you nude in that scene. Did your friends
right.
see you in the scene?
A couple of them did, and then I got a lot of date calls.
Oh, really? So it worked in your favor?
Like I said, I wouldn't mind another shot now. He said, well, I'm not giving another shot. I had to fill in for you last time.
Now you were in the position, I mean, you not only like play your father in Badass, but you were in your father's position of having to cast a boy to play the role that your father made you play when he was making his film. So how did you cast for it? Who did you choose, and how explicit did you want to make your version of his scene?
Well, I thought I didn't want to make anyone do that scene twice, so in Badass, I just used the original footage of me as a kid in Sweetback during that scene. So the kid I cast wasn't going to have to do anything like that. And that's just something that I wanted to do. Was, you know, I'm not going to repeat, you know, do unto someone else what I didn't like done unto me. But I did want to show the scene because I thought it was a point in my life. And it just showed something interesting about Melvin, that he was sort of like that great Santini-esque father, almost that which does not kill you in a Nietzsche-esque way makes you stronger. And if I bounce this basketball off your head a little bit, well, you'll be tough and you'll know how to deal. And, you know, so he has his whole philosophy. And, you know, I'm a filmmaker and I've benefited from him, you know, knocking down the doors he knocked down. Absolutely.
Did your father charge you a lot of money for rights to use the scene in your film?
That's a good question. This guy is a trip, man. So I go to my dad. I say, okay, now listen, I got the movie funded. So I go to see my old man about, because I wanted to put some clips of his film Sweetback in my film Badass. And he says, great. Yeah, just tell me the scenes you want and I'll put them up and you can pay for them. I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is product placement. People will see Badass and want to see Sweetback. What are you talking about? This is product placement. He goes, no, you got to pay for them just like anybody else. So sure enough, I wound up writing him a check. I think it was for $2,500 and giving it to him, which he promptly cashed. And then he turned around and said, by the way, I want to take you and all your Badass kids on vacation. And he wound up spending about $5,000 to take us on this lovely vacation on an island in Guana. And take my sister and her kids as well. So he's a funny dude because in one hand he's doing the business deal with his son and he's, you know, taking the money and in the other pocket he's putting twice as much back. But that's Melvin Van Movies.
Mario Van Peebles speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. His father, filmmaker Melvin Van Peebles, died last week at the age of 89. We'll hear more from Mario after a break. Plus, we'll remember John Shelby Spong, an Episcopal bishop who pushed the church to accept LGBTQ and women clergy. And we'll hear my review of the new Netflix series Made. I'm David B. Inkooli, and this is Fresh Air.
Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Little Brown Books for Young Readers, publisher of A Tale of Sorcery, the latest adventure in Chris Colfer's A Tale of Magic series. The Land of Stories author presents another tale of action, adventure, and magic. Available now. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working together to create a just world where all people have access to renewable energy, clean air and water, and healthy food. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David B. Inkooli, in for Terry Gross. We're listening back to Terry's 2004 interview with Mario Van Peebles, the son of filmmaker Melvin Van Peebles, who died last week at age 89. Mario Van Peebles directed the film Badass, which is about the making of his father's 1971 film, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. Mario also starred in the film, playing his father.
I think the way you play your father in your movie Badass, it kind of walks the line between obsessively adhering to his artistic vision and being selfish, and walks the line between being confident and arrogant. I thought that seemed, not knowing him, to have a ring of truth to it. How did you see him when you were 12 and he was making the movie? Did you see him as confident or arrogant? Did you see him as selfish?
You know, I don't know that as 12 I I analyzed it.
And when I say selfish, I mean because he was putting a lot of family kind of interests on the back burner to make this movie. He was
totally
losing
obsessed,
money.
Yes.
He's totally obsessed. He was losing money.
Single vision, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, he's a driven cat. And, you know, there's that scene in Badass where he says to Big T, Big T is, the crew has spent a weekend in jail. And Big T, who's the big, you know, muscled sound man, is really pissed by this. And my dad has that scene where he says, look, you know, this is bigger than you. I got all my stuff on the line and all my family stuff. This is a war. It's our war to take back our imagery. We'll not be butlers. We won't be shuffling. It's bigger than you. It's bigger than me. And if you don't know that, then quit. You know, and if you're going to say you're going to kick my ass, do it. And if I was afraid of you, I wouldn't be the kind of brother to get this thing done. And that's very much my pop. And he's still that way to this day. What he believes in, he stands for. And I respect that. And he made changes. I wouldn't have been able to get Badass done the same way. I mean, now, 30 years later, I could get a union crew that was multiracial, where there were women on the crew, there were Asians on the crew. My DP was a 63-year young Jewish brother, and my Asian set decorator and designer, and the young sister with the fro who did the wardrobe. I could get, because my dad had broken the unions and made sure that these people could work. I directed a film called New Jack City in 1991-90. And the guy that came to me, who was my producer, Preston Holmes, said, you know how I got my job? I said, how? He said, because your dad was willing to get fired so that all of us could come on as crew. And he did get fired. He insisted we stay. And that's how I got my job. And so I look at the changes he made. And I'm like, wow, I don't know if I'd have the freedom I do now as a filmmaker had I not had, you know, this dad who was willing to pay the cost to be the godfather of soul cinema.
I know actors often feel that when they put on the costumes, you know, or the wardrobe for a movie, that they are transformed by those clothes. Now, in your case, you were wearing what I imagine were clothes very similar to what you remembered your father wearing when your father made Sweet Sweetback. So how did you feel in those clothes, saying the things you remembered your father saying, and doing your best to become him? Could you just, like, talk about what that felt like?
Oh, to play your father, making a film that you remember him making, and you were on that set. I had some of the very same clothes that he wore. That sort of pimpy, crushed velvet, gold, obnoxious outfit, for example. I don't know where he got that outfit. That thing was horrendous. Anyway, I had them get me another outfit and make me an outfit like that. And we were shooting a scene in L.A. in the hood. And since it was an independent film and I only had 18 days to make the movie, I used my own truck. See, that was my camera vehicle. So I had my truck, and I had the DP stick the camera out the window. He hadn't been to the hood, so he was like, he's a little nervous. He's sticking the camera out the window. I said, okay, here's the deal. We don't have permits for any of this. I'm going to walk on the other side of the street. And when I signal you, I'm going to run through the ghetto. And you photograph me, but we're only get one shot at it because the second time I run through, they're going to recognize me. So I got on the Mac Pimp Daddy suit. I got the mustache just like Dad. And I signal him. He starts driving the truck. They're shooting out the window. And I run past these old cats in the hood. One brother's looked up. He's been drinking Ripple on that same corner for like 90 years. And the guy looks up and he sees me running and he goes, Sweetback's back! He came back. The brother came back just like he said he came back. It was surreal. We went to the very same places my dad went in the ghetto because he was avoiding the unions, and in the desert because the unions couldn't find him and they were scared to go in the hood. And we went to the same locations and did the same stuff. I mean, 33 years later. In fact, we even shot on the very street he lived on, his office was on.
You know how no matter how much you love somebody, they often have, like, a certain gesture that really gets on your nerves? I'm wondering if your father had something like that that you had to recreate when you were playing him.
Yeah, I did. There are many things. One is he eats with his fingers. And what he does is he says he doesn't want to eat anything. He likes to stay nice and slim. He's got a great stomach. He's, you know, he can still outrun me. He's 71 years old. He's a bad brother. But how he does that is psychologically, he's understood that what he doesn't order won't make him fat. So he encourages you to order something. He gets a mere salad or whatever. And then he'll reach over and put his fingers right into your food and sort of smack it up. The second thing is, growing up with my dad, was like growing up, if you're a woman and you grew up with Margaret Thatcher as your mother, whether you agree with mommy's politics or not, whether you agree with her politics, it would be very hard for men to convince you that a woman could have no place in the old boy network of politics. Growing up with my dad, who did speak French, who did speak Dutch, who was one of the first black officers in the Air Force, was never on drugs, was never in jail, didn't play basketball, and didn't rap, was liberating because I thought it's all possible. And that was the biggest gift, was that I saw the possibilities of what one could do.
Well, Mario Von Peebles, thank you so much for talking with us.
I love talking with you and would, you know, do it anytime. Green Eggs and Ham, anywhere, on a boat, on a moat, in Philly, wherever.
Mario Von Peebles speaking with Terry Gross in 2004. His father, filmmaker Melvin Von Peebles, died last week at age 89. After a break, we remember Bishop John Shelby Spong, who championed the acceptance of women and LGBTQ people in the clergy. This is Fresh Air.
For NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
This is Fresh Air. Now we're going to listen to Terry's interview with John Shelby Spong, an Episcopal bishop who championed the acceptance of women and LGBTQ people in the clergy. He also promoted a non-literal interpretation of Scripture. He died earlier this month at age 90. From 1976 to the year 2000, he served as the Episcopal bishop of Newark, New Jersey. In 1977, he became one of the first American bishops to ordain a woman into the clergy. In 1989, he was the first to ordain an openly gay man. Bishop Spong was the author of more than 25 books, and his speaking schedule often included 200 events a year. Terry Gross spoke with Bishop Spong in 1996 after the publication of his book, Liberating the Gospels, Reading the Bible with Jewish Eyes.
Let me ask you about one of your most controversial actions as the Episcopal Bishop of Newark. You ordained a gay man shortly after the Episcopal Church said that it was okay to ordain non-celibate homosexuals. Who was the man and why did you choose him to be the first?
The first homosexual person that I ordained knowingly was a man named Robert Williams. And this came after I had written a book called Living in Sin on the whole gay issue, as well as some other patterns in human sexual life that I think we need to look at and reassess from a different perspective than the traditional one. And Robert Williams was a brilliant graduate of the Episcopal Theological Seminary in Cambridge, which is part of the Harvard complex. He wrote and said, "If you really believe what you have written in that book, I wish you would test it on me." And so I invited him to come down to the Diocese of Newark and to be interviewed. And then I ordained him to the diaconate. That was in June of 1989. There was absolutely no controversy about that. A full-page story on the second front of the New York Times showed what Robert was doing. We had opened a ministry to gay and lesbian people out of Hoboken, New Jersey, which has a very strong and very large homosexual population. And he began to work among these people, most of whom are deeply alienated from the church because the only message they've ever heard from the church is that God hates homosexual people and that they ought to either be converted to being heterosexuals or be thrown out of the church or even executed, as the book of Leviticus says.
We wound up ordaining
him to the priesthood in 1989 in December, and for some reason the religious right led by the Bishop of Fort Worth, Texas, decided to make that a cause celebre, and so they went to the newspapers and they called press conferences and they condemned this action, and they lifted Robert Williams and the Diocese of Newark into an enormous amount of national controversy.
Now, you ended up having to ask for his resignation.
Yes.
After he said, what, bad things about monogamy?
Well, that was one of the things. Robert Williams became, because of the publicity that surrounded his ordination, he became a media star almost immediately, and he was not very well equipped by either background or experience to handle the pressures. And he went to Detroit, and he was in a press conference, and he was being badgered by a very hostile reporter, and he blew his cool and began to say things that made his ministry in the Diocese of Newark, we were right far out on a line to support him, almost impossible to defend. He said that monogamy was a heterosexual practice and should never be imposed upon homosexual people. He went on to say that everybody would profit with sexual activity, and then the reporter said, you mean to tell me that even Mother Teresa would be better off if she had a sexual experience? And Robert said, I don't know whether I ought to say exactly what Robert said on the radio, but Robert allowed as how Mother Teresa would be better off if she engaged in sexual activity. Well, that just blew headlines across the country. Now, he had been ordained to open a ministry to gay and lesbian people in the Diocese of Newark so that we could hold up to the gay and lesbian population the model of a faithful, committed, lifetime partnership. Robert represented himself as living in that. I had met his partner, and they had been together for something like 4 years. And that was the basis upon which he was ordained. And then he began to say that he did not think faithfulness to a partner was a virtue that homosexual people ought to be held to, and that he began to prescribe sexual activity sort of random or promiscuous. And there is no way that I as a bishop or our diocese was prepared to support promiscuous sexual activity on anybody's part, whether it's homosexual or heterosexual.
What was it like for you to go out on a limb to ordain a gay priest and then have to ask for his resignation? Were you embarrassed? Did you think you had made a mistake or had made a bad choice?
No, I don't think I've made a mistake on that yet. I think both decisions were appropriate decisions, and I believe I would do both of them over again. Robert Williams taught me far more about the meaning of homosexual persons and the value that they have to bring to the life of the church than he ever hurt me. And I honor him. Robert died of AIDS about 2 years after I ordained him, which was another piece of our life, because Robert had indicated in the interview that he was not, that he was in complete health, and he was clearly HIV positive and headed toward his soon-to-be death. So that Robert, for me, was symbolic of the fact that gay and lesbian people have been so abused by the church, and yet despite that abuse, they still yearn to be part of it, and they will do almost anything to become part of it. And Robert opened the door to enormous numbers of gay and lesbian people to find their way back into the church that will be an accepting community. And we today have a significant number of gay and lesbian priests serving the Diocese of Newark with incredible distinction. The most recent one that's been involved in the controversy was Barry Stopfel, who was ordained priest by me but ordained deacon by Bishop Ryder. And some bishops of the church tried to put Bishop Ryder on trial for heresy for ordaining him to the diaconate. They did not seem to want to put me on trial for heresy for ordaining him to the priesthood, though I would have welcomed that opportunity to defend that point of view.
Now, I believe you oversaw or initiated a church study on how changing ideas and changing sexual practices should affect the church. Could you sum up some of the things that you found in that study?
Sure. That was done in the Diocese of Newark in 1986 and 1987, and it was a profoundly shaping experience for the whole of the Episcopal Church and maybe even for the whole of Christendom. What we did was to begin to study changing patterns in family life. It was a rather innocuous beginning. But in this changing patterns of family life, we began to be aware that a vast majority of our young people today do not wait until they are married to initiate their sexual activity. That's just a fact. People might like it or dislike it, but it's just a fact. Another aspect of life that we wanted to look at was, what do you do with post-married people? By that I mean people who are divorced or people who are widowed. are they supposed to either remain sexually celibate or to immediately get married again so that they can have a legitimate partner with which they can exercise their sexual lives? And then we looked at the gay and lesbian population that under the laws of the states of the United States of America and every country of the world are not given the privilege of a legal relationship. And we raised questions about that. I think the first issue was that I became aware that sex inside marriage is not always holy. Rape takes place inside marriage. Sexual abuse takes place inside marriage. It is not marriage that makes sexual activity holy. It's the quality of the relationship. So if sex inside marriage is not always holy, we had to face the question that sex outside marriage might not always be sinful. We began by looking at the young people. When you go back to the Middle Ages, when the standards of the church were proclaimed that sex was to be exercised only inside the marital relationship, people entered puberty in that era at ages 15, 16, and 17. They didn't live much past 30 or 40. They tended to get married within a year or a year and a half of puberty. We don't live in that kind of world. Through better diet and many other things, we have run the age of puberty back to 11, 12, and 13 because we honor women with the understanding that they are equal and that they have brains that are capable of being educated. University-educated women like you, Terry, are a 20th century phenomenon in the Western world. There were very few university-educated women before the turn of the century. But because of that, we've pushed the age of marriage for women into the mid-20s so that we've created a 10 to 15-year gap between puberty and marriage in this society. And we've not bothered to recognize that the standard of the Middle Ages was applied in a world where there might be a 1 to 2 year gap between puberty and marriage and a whole different set of circumstances. Now, I don't know anybody that's suggesting that people ought to get married at age 13 and 14 so that they can be sexually celibate until they're married. But that's the reality that we're dealing with. Now, the only way you can keep people sexually celibate, it seems to me, for 10 to 15 years after puberty, is to impose upon the activity of sex enormous controls like guilt and fear. And that's exactly what the Christian church has done through the years. And I do not think that that is loving, and I do not think that that's an appropriate way to proclaim the fullness of life for God's people.
Bishop John Shelby Spong, speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. He died earlier this month at age 90. After a break, I review the new Netflix series, Made. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bean Cooley. Today, Netflix launches a new drama series called Made, inspired by the best-selling memoir by Stephanie Land called Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. In it, Land wrote candidly about her years living below the poverty line, trying to raise her young daughter while working as a maid for hire. Most TV dramas adapted from books are identified in the opening credits as based on. But this new 10-episode Netflix version is called Inspired By, and there's a lot of new fictional material added to the mix. This includes some new characters and some changing of actual locations and events. But the original author, whose life experiences are at the center of Made, is on record approving of the TV show's approach, And the creative team has done a great job making this story both captivating and relatable. The executive producers include actress Margot Robbie and veteran TV writer-producer John Wells, whose credits include China Beach, ER, and The West Wing. He also was a writer and director on Shameless, the recently concluded excellent Showtime series about a family struggling to make ends meet. Another writer on that series was Molly Smith Metzler, who is the creator of this new Maid series for Netflix. She wrote many of the episodes of Maid, Wells directed four of them, and together they've crafted a story that's told entirely from one point of view, with misunderstandings, missing information, and flashes of fantasy all as part of the mix. Maid is the story of Alex, a young woman who, in the opening scene, wakes up in the middle of the night, sneaks out of bed where her husband Sean is sleeping, and carries their 2-year-old daughter, Maddie, to the car, preparing to drive off. Where, we don't know. And neither does she. But before long, Alex, who's played by Margaret Qualley, ends up at the office of a social worker. She's looking for help and some leads on possible employment, but what she gets first are a series of questions.
Are you the child's legal guardian?
Yes.
Can you prove that?
I can show you my stretch marks.
Are you currently under the influence of any drugs or alcohol?
No.
Are you sure? Because you look strung out.
Nope. We slept in the car last night, so...
So you're homeless?
No. No, I wouldn't say that.
So you have a home?
I had a home, and then we left it.
Alex has few options at the moment, and even less money. She starts out with access to only $18, and we see that amount dwindle on screen with every purchase of another gallon of gas or dollar store toy for Maddie. Eventually, Alex does get a shot at a job interview to work as a maid for hire at a daily cleaning service. But to land that job, she has to find someone to watch her daughter. And with no money to pay a sitter, her only choice is a risky one. Her own mother, a free-spirited artist with wild sculptures and paintings, wild hair, and wild, manic eyes. She's played by Andy McDowell, who dives into playing her manic, depressive character with all the fire and energy it requires.
Hi, Mom.
Ah! Maddie! Alex! This is so exciting. I can't believe you came to see this. This is what all the brilliant painters and sculptors are doing in the art world right now. This is me stepping up to a global collective of minds.
Hey, Mom.
Archetypes. You know about archetypes.
Hey.
That's what I'm representing here in Cobalt. The hero, the everyman, the mentor, the mystic, the
Mom.
Lover. Then, of course, there's
Mom.
Youngin archetypes.
This Why didn't you tell me that you Airbnb'd your house?
I did, didn't I?
I just drove around to 2 campgrounds looking for you.
Well, honey, if you don't check in with me from time to time, that's on you.
I called you 14 times.
Margaret Qualley played dancer Anne Reinking in the FX limited series Fosse Verdon, but that was a glamorous supporting role. Her Alex in Maid is a central starring role. It's Alex's journey every step of the way. We never know what's happening or who's doing what until Alex does. She keeps confronting crises, making decisions, and moving forward, battling red tape and family members. The supporting cast is deep and strong, but in the first few episodes, the best scenes are between Alex and her mom. And it's worth noting, though I didn't know it until afterward, that Andy McDowell and Margaret Qualley are mother and daughter in real life. As to Alex's life, as depicted in Maid, we never once leave her narrative or her perspective. And the TV show finds very inventive ways to help us empathize with her point of view. The most dramatic thing that happens in the first episode occurs off camera because Alex is too far away to see it. And we hear only the sound, as does she. Later, when she's in court fighting for custody of her daughter, all the words the attorneys and judges throw back and forth devolve into what she hears, and we hear, only as the repeated phrase, legal, legal, legal. And as she flips through the endless sheets of forms she has to fill out for job and financial assistance applications, the words on the pages, to her eyes and to ours, get more personal, more pessimistic, and a lot more rude. Any description of maid threatens to sound unremittingly bleak, but it's not. And the moments of joy that surface, the small victories, the unexpected showings of support, the real message of maid is that each one of those small acts of kindness is indeed what can keep Alex going. And really, any of us. Monday on Fresh Air, we'll talk about film noir. Movies about doomed characters, sexual heat, ill-fated romance, schemers, crimes, and double crosses. Movies that often are filmed in shadows as dark as their stories. Our guest will be Eddie Muller, host of the Turner Classic Movies show Noir Alley and author of a new expanded edition of his book Dark City, The Lost World of Film Noir. Some noir classics are set in the boxing world, a world Muller came to know through his father, who was considered the dean of West Coast boxing writers. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Roberta Shurrock and Seth Kelly. Our technical director is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support by Julian Hertzfeld and Joyce Lieberman. Our engineer today is Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, and Kayla Lattimore. Our producer of digital media is Molly C.B. Nesper. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Penguin Random House, publisher of presidential inaugural poet Amanda Gorman's Change Sings, a picture book anthem about working together to make change, illustrated by Lauren Long, available where books are sold. And from DuckDuckGo, a privacy company committed to making privacy online simple. Used by tens of millions, they offer private search and tracker blocking with one download, DuckDuckGo. Privacy simplified.